Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, the show where you get the inside access to the best minds in the game. Each week, Chris has the privilege of chatting with top instructors, legendary players, course architects, and industry insiders. If you're looking to improve your game, gain a new perspective, or just hear some incredible golf stories, you are indeed in the right place.
You see, Chris, I haven't spoken to a press man in my life that is knowledgeable, seriously, as you are. Never.
You do such a great job. It kind of makes me feel good all of a sudden.
You do so much for the game. You're so kind to all of us that are out there in the game. You know, we need more people like you in the game of golf.
Thank you for pressing play. Now, grab your clubs, step up to the tee, and let's get started. This is Next on the Tee.
Hey, Next on the Tee Nation. Thanks for coming back and tuning in to this very special segment of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and I have the privilege of getting to spend some time with two of my favorite guests, two guys that are out there playing on the Champions Tour, Olin Brown and Billy Mayfair. You guys know both of them. They've been fantastic guests on this show for many years. Olin, a great college player at Occidental College, their MVP award is now named in his honor. He won out on the Korn Ferry Tour. He has won on the PGA Tour, and he has won a couple of times so far out on the Champions Tour. 2011 U.S. Senior Open champion, so he's a major champion out there. Billy Mayfair, a former U.S. amateur champion. He has also won several times out on the PGA Tour, five and all. And now out there continuing to play on the PGA Tour Champions and feeling very strongly about his game heading into this season, which you'll hear. So, folks, I can't thank you enough for making Next on the Tee a part of your regular golf content. I'm so excited to bring these conversations to you. You're going to learn more about them as individuals. You're going to learn more about their careers. You're going to learn about how they feel heading into this season and about all the changes that are about to take place in 2026 around the PGA Tour, and maybe a little bit of excitement about potentially Tiger Woods joining them out on the Champions Tour next year. He turns 50 in late December. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour or so. Okay, before we get started, I want to give a shout out to our friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. TribLive.com is the leading news website for Western Pennsylvania with news around the clock. Pittsburgh Pro Sports coverage, a high school sports network, a podcast network, which you can find Next on the Tee on. So go out and bookmark TribLive.com or download the Trib Live app for free and stay up to date with all the news in Western Pennsylvania and this show. I also want to talk about our friends over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company and Iron City Beer, a brand that I have loved my whole life and started drinking when I was 21 years old, of course. Whether you're a hacker or a scratcher, the secret to a successful day on the links is knowing when it's time to grab an iron, even if that means keeping it in the bag till the 19th hole. If it's been a while since you've reached for Pittsburgh staple beer, it's time to revisit Iron City. Thanks to their incredible new facility in Creighton, the best tasting Iron City beer ever made is now available at a course near you. Iron City pairs well with any lie and sky and serves as a friendly reminder that there's always next round. Iron City Beer. Best enjoyed while enjoying life. And this year, get ready to experience a game like never before at The Keep, the brand new Bill Bergen and Reese Jones co-designed course at Macklemore. Nestled high atop Lookout Mountain, The Keep offers breathtaking vistas that are made even more spectacular as the autumn colors paint the landscape in rich hues of red, orange, and gold. With its challenging layout and awe-inspiring views, every round here is an unforgettable adventure. Whether you're taking on the signature holes or just soaking in the scenery, The Keep is where your best golf meets nature's finest backdrop. So grab your clubs and join us up at Macklemore. The Keep is open for preview play, and it's waiting for you. and experience distance and forgiveness all at once with the new QI35 driver from TaylorMade. QI35 is designed to give golfers more distance from more of the face while maintaining maximized forgiveness through high MOI designs. Whether you're looking for low spin and maximum workability or easy launch and plenty of adjustability, it's available in low spin, core, and max models. QI35 also has a full assortment of fairway woods and rescues to deliver distance and forgiveness throughout the top end of your bag. Check them all out online at TaylorMadeGolf.com. All right, now back with me is another one of my all-time favorite guests, Olin Brown. This makes the 14th time that I've had the privilege of getting to spend some time with Olin. Let me remind you about his background. He's from Washington, D.C. Played his college golf out at Occidental College in L.A. He joined the golf team as a sophomore and gradually moved up to being their number one player. He was named a first-team all-conference, all-SCIAC golfer in 1980 and again in 82. He was inducted into their Golf Hall of Fame in 1997, and their Golf Annual MVP Award is now named in his honor. He turned pro in 1984. He won four times out on what is now the Korn Ferry Tour, twice in 91, once in 93, and again in 96. He's won three times out on the PGA Tour and twice so far out on the Champions Tour. In 2005, he was named the PGA Tour Comeback Player of the Year. In 2011, he added a major championship to his resume, winning the U.S. Senior Open at Inverness over in Toledo, Ohio. And over the course of his playing career, he's had those five wins, plus 102 top 10 finishes, 253 top 25s. And he's a guy I'm rooting hard for each and every week out there on the Champions Tour, and I couldn't be more excited. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, O, how are you, my friend?
We used up most of our time with that intro, bro.
I didn't know I was on a shot clock.
Good to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
All right, so a couple of things right up front. First of all, before we get into all the golf stuff, I got to ask you, your folks back at Occidental College, LA Fires, is everyone okay out there? Is everything all right at the school?
Yeah, Occidental is kind of wedged in between Pasadena and LA, and so it was just south and west of the Altadena Pasadena issues, and I think as far as I know things are pretty okay now. I got a really good friend who's a fire chief out there, captain, and I talked to him and he said it's worse than you're seeing on TV. And wow. Of course all of our prayers are going out to everybody who's involved with that, but it's just one of those horrifying convergences of situation and weather and I don't know about the other stuff, but just one of those kind of terrible occurrences that we experience every now and then. If a hurricane devastates, you know, like Katrina hit New Orleans and the fires there in LA, it's inexplicably difficult for people. And so a lot of people are in our thoughts and prayers.
100%. All right, so let's talk about happier things on the opposite side of that coin. You're Washington Commanders, my friend. How surprised were you about how well they turned it around this season?
Well, I think shocked is probably at the forefront of everybody's, you know, kind of thinking. I think everybody was excited when they were able to get Jaden Daniels. I was very pleased that Chicago grabbed Caleb Williams because there was something special about his season last year. And guys like that, the last guy who had a college season that was reminiscent of what Jaden Daniels did last year was Joe Burrow. Just happened to be at the same school. And I think there are parallels to be drawn there. And then the way Burrow took on the NFL quickly, and Jaden Daniels proved his mettle right away. He earned a captaincy. He earned the starting job. He earned the respect of his teammates. And the guy has no heart rate. You know, I mean, you look at him in the heat of the moment and, his eyes don't dance and he's sitting there calmly. He's not trying to suck in air. He just seems like he's made for that environment. And he proved it over and over and over and over again as they made a run right into the playoffs. And then they went into Detroit and beat what was really
arguably the best team in the NFC. I mean, they were decimated by injuries, but they were a juggernaut all year. And the number one seed, and they won that game. And so, you know, you can't say enough positive things about the way the team handled it. Dan Quinn, coming from Dallas, you know, has obviously put his stamp on things. But again, I don't think anybody could have imagined that the kid was going to take the reins of the franchise and handle it to the level that he did. And so you can't say enough positive things about him and about the way the team went. And I think the excitement for next year is going to be off the charts.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, take what you said a moment ago a step further. Obviously, Daniels is the star of the team. Terry McLaurin, the two of them are a heck of a combination. Dan Quinn, to your point, coming over from Dallas. Dan Snyder being out the door. It seems like all of the good things sort of came together that allowed this team to go from 4-13 to 12-5 and in an NFC championship game. The arrow was pointing way up. It seems like it's going to be the Commanders and the Eagles fighting it out for the next several years. You leapfrog Dallas, you know, the Giants are way down in the doldrums. But those two teams seem like they're going to be fighting it out for NFC championships for a while now.
Well, everything is dependent on health and, you know, whether they can really cobble together. I imagine they have some pretty good cash reserves right now. They're able to sign a couple of guys they need. They need another guy on offense, I think. Maybe some, some interior linemen so that they can get some heavy running going, although they ran the ball better down the stretch than they did generally as the year progressed. They kind of blossomed into the team that they became there for the playoffs as the season went on. And, Sainer still looks like he was a really good pickup slot corner, but played a lot of over on the edge and matched up with other teams' lead receivers and so forth. And, I think they did a hell of a job. And I don't know Dan Snyder. I never met the man. But, you know, for 20-plus years, he's made Washington fans miserable. And I don't think there are a lot of teary-eyed people that he's not involved any longer.
All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk a little golf. And want to get your thoughts. One of the big stories on the PGA Tour has been, unfortunately, in my opinion, the adoption of smaller fields, fewer tour cards, cutting the number of Monday qualifiers, doing that in half. They already have 8 signature events, which have limited fields with no cuts. In my mind, this was all done to compete with LIV, and so the top players can get a larger share of the pie. But it comes at the expense of the guys like the grinders on tour, the guys that are making the great stories that come from nowhere to inside the top 125, inside the top 100, the guys that make the Monday qualifiers and go on to win a tournament or at least contend. I don't know. Oh, what are your thoughts? I feel like this isn't a great thing for the tour.
You know, the tour was founded in 1968 when it broke away from the PGA of America because it wanted more autonomy, right?
Yep.
And, these kinds of issues have been part of the conversation for a long while. And back when Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and guys like that were leading the tour, they were trying to figure out a way to showcase them better and maybe peel them off for event. They understood the value of a legacy, and a legacy against a legitimate field in legitimate tournaments on a legitimate tour. And you know what? Look, I was never a star. I had a pretty good career on tour. I played 17 or 18 years out there. And I think that my age group, my peers, the guys that I grew up playing with and idolizing and playing against, they don't like what's happening. You know, it seems to me that in a sports environment where sport is expanding, you know, they got expansion franchises every now and then in football. They got expansion franchises every now and then in basketball. If they don't like the city that they're in, they move to another one, you know, and they relocate. But, you know, they've expanded football opportunities with first whatever it was, the USFL or the XFL or whatever. There were players that came off of that, out of that environment and had successful careers. And Kurt Warner is one of them, right? And ended up winning a Super Bowl and going to the Hall of Fame. And so I'm not a fan of reducing opportunities. The problem is that the tour freaked out when Liv did what it did. And in an effort to respond to what they did, they dropped the hammer on their best sponsors and said, you guys have to jack your purses. You got to double them. And they're trying to squeeze blood from a stone everywhere they can. I don't know. It seems to me like part of the deal with being a PGA Tour member is that you were part of an enterprise that was building a legacy and establishing legitimacy for the long term. And I have a hard time looking at these players nowadays and thinking that they're caring about building anything and leaving anything behind. I think they're just trying to take the chips from the middle of the table and bring them to their side of what's what. And
yeah,
you know, I understand it's the ultimate high wire act, right? It's the ultimate capitalistic sport. You eat what you kill. And that's part of the process. And people, you know, they get maybe callous about it. You certainly have to be tough. You're exposed at all times. I mean, look what a guy like Rory goes through every time there's a major championship that, for example, coming up, Augusta, where everybody in the world wants him to win it. And it's really going to be the lead talking point. Or his performance at the Open Championship when Cam Smith won it, or at the U.S. Open last year at Pinehurst. You know, the exposure for a guy like that, you know, he's bearing the brunt of a lot. You know, and everybody wants him to succeed, but they also want the contrast between, you know, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, that whole thing. So I just find it hard to believe that the millions and millions of dollars that these top players are making isn't satisfying to them. I mean, there are two things. Paul Ezinger said it forever. He said players choke for two things. They choke for history and they choke for cash. But there needs to be a legitimate tour. And if you start reducing fields and if you have every tournament, I mean, the biggest argument that the tour was trying to make about LIV is that it's got short fields. Well, if you got elevated events with 70 players in them and the same players are playing against each other all the time, you don't have any storylines there. You got the same outcome all the time. Scotty Scheffler dominated last year. I would think it'd be boring to watch the same guys play against each other all the time. I'd like to see some fresh blood out there. And you certainly are robbing, it seems to me, Peter to pay Paul on this one. If you just take everything and shrink it down, because the next generation, what are you going to do for the next series of stars that's going to float the boat, right? There's a lot to talk about here, and we could take up the whole show. I guess the short answer to your question is, I don't like seeing what's happening, and I don't think that the current enterprise that's being founded or built is building something that has lasting power or that has, you know, any kind of a legacy to it. I just think, seems to me that you got rich guys complaining about not making enough money, and so they're orchestrating things so that they get more of the pie.
Yes, 100% there. So let me react to a couple of things you just said, though, because this whole reaction that the PGA Tour has had to live, I kind of go back to the 80s when Pepsi started spending a lot of money on commercials and getting people like Michael Jackson involved and that sort of thing. And Coke reacted by, oh, we got to change our formula. Now we need new Coke to stay up to date with what Pepsi's out there doing. When that,
yeah,
didn't
that was
need
maybe
to
the biggest single flop ever.
Right. That didn't need to happen at all. I feel like the PGA Tour has overreacted to what LIV has done. They could have just kept things going the way it was. Everything would have been fine, but they've overreacted. And now it has become, like you said, and I've said on this show for the last several months, it's become about money. And to your point, the same guys. LIV has 48 guys. The PGA Tour is going to have 70 or 80 guys in these signature events. The same guys with the same amount of money making themselves richer. And to me, that is why we're seeing so many people tune out and the ratings fall down, because people are tired of seeing PGA golf be all about money. These millionaires talking, trying to get more of that pie. And it's just becoming a thing that none of us can relate to. I mean, I think you and your generation, and even, you know, probably the generation after you, did a heck of a job. And in the 30,000 PGA of America professionals have done a lot of work trying to get golf from being thought of as just an elitist sport. We're getting more and more people involved in the game. It's healthier at my level, at the amateur level, than it's probably ever been. But now we've got the PGA Tour turning it around and turning a lot of people off, because it does feel like it's an elitist game at the pro level, and people are sick of that.
Well, I think a major complaint about modern professional sports is that the athletes aren't as compelling, because they're much more buttoned down, they're much more corporate, but they're less interesting because it takes so much of a commitment. And there's so much to be made from it that, you know, like, the characters of the game are a thing of the past, right?
Yeah, that's a great point.
You know, you don't hear stories anymore in the NFL, like, from people like Artie Donovan, right? Who was one of the all-time characters, or Jack Lambert, or people like that. But you need a career, and you need to be part of a legacy in order for that to have legs. And I think that when rich guys fly in private, complain about not making enough money, it falls on deaf ears, because people just, they're not interested in that. They're interested in the truth, which is the sport, which is the competition. And if you minimize the number of guys, or you reduce the number of guys, the competition is less compelling. You know, you have a 70-man field with no cut. Who cares, right? Guys are showing up. They're not giving their best. If they're in the bottom half of the field, they couldn't care less. They're going to cash their $150,000 check and fly home on their net check. And I think there's some of that that's really off-putting. And it's a privilege to be able to do something like this for an entire career. I'm 65 now. I've done it since I was in my 20s. I got on tour when I was in my early 30s, but let's call it for 30 years. I've been able to compete at the professional level, and I consider that such a privilege. And I know these guys, they're in the throes of it right now, and I'm sure that they feel the same way to some extent. But, you know, in this day and age, things are tough all around for a lot of people. I think a little more self-awareness would be maybe be the call of the day.
100%. Couldn't have said it better. Let's take a little different bent a little bit. I've talked with several of your peers, and to a man, they've told me that if Dean Beaman was still the commissioner of the PGA Tour, we never would have had the split in the pro game that we're seeing now. LIV never would have become a thing. Same holds true if Mr. Palmer were still alive. Do you agree with that?
It's a loaded question for sure. You know, Dean Beaman didn't allow beards, and we sure as hell weren't wearing shorts in practice rounds. And there was a protocol, and people were expected to adhere to it. You needed to speak positively about the tournaments and about the golf courses and about the whole entire experience. And, you know, in this day and age, things, the information age, things have been a little bit looser, and people are allowed to be a little bit more honest about the way they feel about things. And look, the media want to get into the players' lives, right? They want to know what they're doing, what they're feeling, how they're going about what they're doing. But it's a dangerous place to be, because, you know, there are guys who have answered some questions really honestly and been taken to the woodshed in public by commentators or newspaper guys or talk show hosts or whatever. And so it's a very difficult line to toe. I think it's probably not accidental that Arnold Palmer wasn't around by the time this thing happened. I think that he would have been a very strong voice. Now, if he'd given his voice to the LIV cause, I think they would have had a lot of legitimacy. But I think if he had spoken out in defense of the PGA Tour and the history of the PGA Tour and what he was a part of and what he really built, I think they might have had a harder time. So the very least thing that you could say about it is, you know, this thing occurred in the absence of probably the greatest name, or one of the five greatest names, let's just say, in our sport. As it pertains to Dean Beaman, Dean had a very clear idea of what he was trying to do. He formulated his plan. He executed his plan, and he didn't bridge any assaults on that juggernaut, right? So I don't necessarily know that Dean would have had a problem with what LIV was doing. He may have found a way to work with them. I think big part of our problems are due to the fact that people wouldn't talk to one another, and whether overtures were made and rejected or whether they were not responded to or whether they were never initiated at all, we'll never know, because you know, there are two sides to this and each side has its story, and somewhere in between the two stories lies the truth. So there's an awful lot of blame to go around to an awful lot of people, and I think that it's really easy in hindsight to maybe have looked at things and tried to approach it differently. I certainly think that, look, if somebody's coming in and they want to become part of who you are and what you do, worst thing that you can do is ignore the idea. You got to at least take a call and have a conversation. I don't know if that ever happened. So,
right.
That's where we are, right? And now we've got a split in golf. Nobody, you know, to my mind, the guys who are least pleased are the guys who left. The guys who stayed. I'm sure that several of them were approached, but elected not to go, right?
Right.
The guys who left, they left stardom and exposure for a globetrotting experience. I haven't seen much LIV stuff. It's not, you know, it's part of the fabric of wherever they go, and it's an experience, but I'm not sure that all those guys are all that ecstatic about. You hear them all saying they want to come back and play majors, and they want to come back and play the tournaments that they miss playing. I mean, they've said that. But, you know, they decided to accept the cash and bolt. So until there's some kind of a reconciliation, we've got divided golf. And I don't think the fans are thrilled about it. But, you know, we got other problems too. You know, the tour for the longest time rode one of the all time ponies in Tiger Woods. I mean, he was the guy for 15 years. Nobody could touch him except Y.E. Yang, right? I mean, he set records left, right, and otherwise. He did things that hadn't been done in the longest time. You know, he made a declarative assault on the record books of golf and the greatest player of the history of the game, Jack Nicklaus, with 20 major championships, counting his U.S. amateurs. And you know, he was an easy guy to follow. He was exciting. He hit the ball like nobody's business. He executed shots. I mean, that shot that he chipped in at Augusta on 16 with Chris DeMarco in the final round. I mean, that kind of stuff is fairy tale stuff.
Right.
And it was like he was the preeminent athlete worldwide. And golf hadn't had that really since Jack, and hadn't had that since Arnold Palmer. And so we were riding high, you know, and while tennis had Federer, or Sampras before him, then he had Djokovic and Nadal. They had a similar type of thing, but they had times three, right? And the big question is, when those kinds of things happen, is what are you going to do when that guy retires or when that guy's no longer relevant? And guys are vying for that slot, right? Who's going to be the next guy that really shoulders the load? Rory was looking like the guy. Then Jordan Spieth was looking like the guy. Scottie Scheffler's looking like the guy now. John Rahm was really looking like the guy, or Brooks Koepka, but those guys bolted, and they're not part of the fabric of the tour right now. So there are a lot of things up in the air, man. And it's really difficult for golf fans. And I think it's difficult on the players too. I think guys are upset that they're not playing against one another more frequently. And I think guys are upset that whether they stayed and wish they had gone, or that they left and they wish they had stayed. And I just think it's in flux.
Yeah. So let me take what you said there at the end, because I do believe the PGA Tour has a problem, because for all of those 15 years, and it's probably been even longer than that, we know Tiger had all the health problems, and there were years he didn't play at all, if you know, maybe just a little. But since 97, I mean, essentially all the PGA Tour eggs have been in the Tiger Woods basket. And to your point, now that Tiger isn't as competitive, and really maybe even competitive at all, I don't think the PGA Tour knows what to do. I mean, here I am in Atlanta. We have the Tour Championship that gets played every year at the end of the season. Not a billboard of Scottie Scheffler, not an ad about Scottie Scheffler, nothing about Xander Schauffele. I feel like the PGA Tour has had their eggs in Tiger's basket for so long. I mean, they had to come up with the TGL thing just so that we can get Tiger out there and in front of people. I mean, to me, it's time to move on. We admire and thank Tiger for everything that he has meant to the game. Unprecedented growth, unprecedented fandom when he came, and it was just, to your point, the most exciting player out on tour for all those years. But now that that's not the case, I keep waiting for the tour to kind of, who's the guy? And to me, it's Scottie Scheffler. How great of a year did Scottie have last year? How much better could it have possibly been? It was a Tiger Woods-esque year. But we don't see the same sort of level of excitement, because I just don't feel like the tour knows how to market anybody not named Tiger.
Tiger made it easy for them. He touched all of the points on the stars. You know, I mean, he looked different. He acted different. He played differently. He did things that were just unique, right? I mean, he pulled off stuff that was impossible, and it was almost surreal. Now Scottie is an entirely different kind of player. He is so good that he seemingly is never out of position, right? And he goes along, and I've heard the broadcast, well, he struggles with his putting. Well, he's hitting 17 greens, he's shooting 66, and he struggles with his putting, really? I mean, to your point, how do you market somebody who's so good he makes it look easy?
You know, plays Tiger boring made, golf.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really been the fundamental of golf for the longest time. The more boring you can make it, the better it is. You're never out of play. You're never right. In jeopardy. You never, you know. But Tiger exposed golf to and golf fans to improbability, to the miracle, right?
Yeah.
The shot that he hit against Grant Waite out of the bunker at the Canadian Open,
right,
over the water from 200 yards with a 6-iron. Really? Are you kidding me? That ball should have gone in the water, or it should have gone over the green, or it should have gone 50 feet left. No, he flagged it. You know, I mean, and then you pan over to Grant Waite and the expression on his face, he goes, are you kidding me? You know, those kinds of moments are what elevated Tiger to, like, you know, theatrical status. It was like watching Jurassic Park the first time, right? I mean, you go, this is incredible. I've never seen anything like it. And I remember the first time I ever played with him was at Castle Pine, the week after he had won at Medina. And he hit his first tee shot, and I looked up there, and I go, oh, my God, that's not how I said it either. I've never seen a ball leave a club like that before. And then it's one of those kind of holes where if I busted two shots, I could get somewhere within chipping distance of the front edge of the green, and he flew the green with his second shot. And I just walked over to him and said, man, I don't want to get in your kitchen here, but can I ask you what you hit there? And he just didn't even blink. He said, 7. So here's a guy who just obliterated the golf ball and then had the finesse and the touch and the putting prowess and all. You know, he was a once-in-a-generation type player. And, you know, once Jack Nicklaus's career had kind of waned, he was in his late 40s, and okay, he won Augusta at 46 or whatever, but he was moving on. Everybody was looking for the next Jack Nicklaus. And first it was going to be Johnny Miller or Tom Watson, and then it was going to be Hal Sutton. Sports has always had that, right? Who's going to be the next Tom Brady? Well, if you watch TV, Patrick Mahomes is the chosen one, right?
Right.
And the league is propping him up. And, you know, to the point where it's almost humorous. You feel like the fix is in because they're ensuring that 7 consecutive title AFC championship games, really? 7 consecutive? I mean, that's above and beyond what Tom Brady did, right?
Mm-hmm.
But sports have always had that. Secretariat obliterated the field in 1973. Everybody's looking for the next Secretariat. Other horses have won the Triple Crown. There has never been another Secretariat. That's just the way it works.
Oh, I want to get your thoughts, too, because one of the things that Rory came out and talked about here in the last couple of days is maybe our sport is potentially oversaturated now. I mean, PGA Tour, Champions Tour, LPGA Tour, Korn Ferry Tour, DP World Tour, LIV, now the TGL League. Is it possible that we just have too much golf to watch?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons to watch golf. One is, in particular, in the winter months, when people are locked in their houses in the Northeast and they get to tune in and watch the W at Wylie, for example, and golf in Hawaii, or primetime golf at Pebble Beach. People want to see those great getaway spots or the classic golf courses. And the other is they tune in to watch great players play great golf. Now, equipment has had an effect on all of this kind of stuff because there are more players capable of doing more and similar things in the game. Whereas in the old days, you know, you heard that mantra about horses for courses, right? The control hitters handled the courses like Harbortown better than the Bombers, and the Bombers handle courses like, I don't know, like Oakmont better than the control hitters or whatever. And now the game has changed so that everybody's going par fives and two. Everybody's hitting 8 irons out of the rough and hitting flyers and hitting them from 185 or 90 yards. And so there's less variety in the game. And I think that we should hold the governing bodies to account for that, because the manufacturers and golf ball technology and equipment technology kind of dusted them off on their way to providing this great playing experience to the average person, right? I think there are a variety of different causes of, you know, the kind of the doldrums that we're in. One is we need star power, right, to float the boat. And it's very difficult for a guy to sustain that star for 20 years, which is really the cycle of a career. And the other thing is that I don't think there's enough variety in the game. And I think that's primarily because everybody hits the ball 300 yards and everybody reaches par fives with 5 irons. And I think that kind of changes strategies and it changes techniques and it changes the way golf is perceived. And to that point, and to their credit, the governing bodies are trying to address that by making some equipment changes. But there's a lot of angst about that. And it's a little bit like the healthcare issue in this country. You know, the advocates want to make it about civil rights, and the people who want to make healthcare a commodity will be at odds about whether it's a civil right or whether it's a commodity, right? And at the same time, the people that are advancing the game or marketing Bryson DeChambeau hitting 350-yard bombs. They don't want to say, well, he ripped that one and it went 275. You know, the guy who led the U.S. Open in driving distance in 1972 at Pebble Beach when it's June and it's a little drier, averaged like 273. You know, the game has changed forever. It's 50 yards different than it used to be. Well, if you extrapolate that over 18 holes, every course should be 900 yards longer. Well, you can't have, there's not enough room. And right. So I think golf is played too much the same week in and week out. There's no variety anymore. And certainly when the wind is blowing, guys are just teeing it down and hitting these knuckle rollers that get out there instead of hitting these crop dusters that end up in cornfields off the off the planet, which adds a lot of thrill and anxiety to what people are watching. So there's a lot of blame to go around for all of that.
Yeah. Justin Thomas made a plea a few days ago to his fellow players and the folks at the PGA Tour, for that matter, for players to be more accessible and more engaging with the fans. I think fans loved Arnie and Phil because they always engaged with the fans, signed every autograph, hung around for hours afterwards. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Is JT right? Should the players become more accessible? Would that make it more interesting and maybe get some more people to come out and watch and tune in?
I don't know. Maybe. I think that the hardcore fans want more information. They want to know what separates the great players from everybody else. I think there's something to that. But, you know, I watched a video of some jerkwad yelling at Zach Johnson last week at Torrey Pines, and his caddy had to come over and confront the guy. And I think that, look, one of the things that I think people have always appreciated about the game is that there's a respect and a reverence for what happens between the ropes. There's a reason that the Open Championship, which is the oldest championship in golf, and the Masters are held in such esteem, because there's, I think, respect for the history of the game in those events that's different than the others. And, you know, the phones are put away at Augusta. Nobody's talking on their phone. They may be filming or whatever, but somehow fans decided that it's okay for them, and certainly with gambling, it's only going to get worse, with them involved, that golf is a better, or sport is better. You know what? I think the sport is what makes the game great. And like, how about the guy who jumped in the water in the playoff between Jeff Sluman and Sandy Lyle back in the day, right? Just a guy who wants to be on TV and act a fool and become part of the story of that tournament. What is that contribution to that sporting event? To me, it isn't. And so I think it's great if fans are genuinely fans and want information and want to learn about what's happening between the ropes. So what makes Scottie Scheffler such an incredible competitor and such a great player? But when they want to interject themselves into the championship itself and become part of it or affect what's happening in the field of play, I'm less inclined to go for that and align with that mentality.
Yeah, same here. Oh, I want to go back into your career just a little bit. And as you know, I'm a Pittsburgh guy, and I can't be more excited that the U.S. Open is back this year at Oakmont. You played in the U.S. Open when it was there in 1994 and again in 2007. And when I look back at that 94 U.S. Open, you had an extremely early tee time on Thursday, 6:40 a.m. alongside Mark Lyon, Brian Kam. I'm guessing they did that because the heat that week was a big part of the story. What do you remember about trying to handle Oakmont, those legendary greens, and also try to deal with the heat?
Well, it was stifling. And I remember they came and got a couple of players off the golf course. I think Chris Patton went down, and the paramedics came in and got him. I think the heat index was in the teens, 100 and teens, maybe 113 or 14. It was Arnie's last event. I remember it. I remember that. And I remember his press conference I remember the rough. They said it was 4 to 6 inches, and it was so long it was lying down over itself. It was more like 14 to 16 inches, and the greens were just as slippery as anything I'd ever seen. And the air didn't move well around the golf course because there were so many trees that had grown over the years, and you just couldn't get your air in your lungs, right? Now, fast forward to 2007, they pulled a bunch of trees out of the golf course, and you could see everything from the clubhouse. I mean, literally almost every hole. And it had this beautiful sweeping vista and, you know, the rolling hills of that area. And it was just magnificent. And so Oakmont is one of those handful of, you know, golf courses that you probably don't need to do too much to it to get it ready for a major championship. It's hosted any number of them. I think it's hosted more U.S. Opens than, I might be wrong about that.
No, but, you're right.
PGA, John Mahaffey won the PGA there, right?
That's right.
And so it's just one of those kind of courses that it seems to hold its own no matter what, and it stands the test of time. And the greens are famous, and the venue is famous, and it's also legendary because it's kind of like Arnold Palmer's backyard, and he kind of laid the foundation for all of this stuff that we're all experiencing now, which is the greatest game with kind of like the longest history that I can think of. It's just an awesome place.
Where does it rank among the toughest courses you ever played?
Well, I felt like the two times that I played it, if you could hit the shot where Oakmont asked you to hit the shots, you could play it. Now, not to say that I did. I probably finished close to dead last in 94 and, I don't know, 40th or 45th in 2007. But Oakmont, if you could hit the fairway and figure out a way to keep your ball on the green, in particular on 1, 10, and 12, you could actually play your way around it. And the beauty of a course like that is as long as you minimize like the doubles, don't make worse than a bogey, you have a chance to make up for it pretty well. The hardest course that I ever played a U.S. Open was Bethpage the first year we played it because it was raining. And it just got so tough. The rough was thick. Nobody could get to the fairway on the 10th hole on Friday's morning round. It was like slightly overdone. But that was as much due to the weather that blew in as it was to the golf course itself. But, you know, there are those golf courses that the USGA kind of tried to steer away from for a couple of years, which are synonymous with U.S. Opens, Oakmont, Wingfoot, Bethpage, Pebble Beach. Those are the ones that really have like the historical reference. And that's where the USGA kind of made its bones, and that's where it should continue going. And I applaud them for kind of doing a rota and throw in an odd course here or there. But make sure that you go back to the old classics because they're classic for a reason. They don't make them anymore. And they definitely identify, you know, the greatness of the players who end up winning the championship.
In 2005, during U.S. Open qualifying, you shot 59 at Woodmont Country Club over in Rockville, Maryland. Did you know on 18 that you needed to shoot a certain score in order to shoot that 59?
No, I had a miserable opening round. I shot 73, and I think I hit 17 greens, and I had a 3-putt. I didn't get up and down the one green that I missed, and I had made one birdie. So two bogeys and a birdie, one over. And I was, you know, really, it was hot and it was miserable and playing congressional that week. And I didn't want to, you know, I was just fatigued. I almost quit, honestly, and ended up going out and playing. And I just lit up the front nine. And by the time I got to 17, I'm starting to understand that I'm going to make it if I just get to the house. But I hooped my second shot on 17. It was a blind second shot. And I made a 2. And now I'm starting to do the math in my head. And I go, the 18th hole is a par 5. If I eagle the par 5, I'll have shot 58. And it'll legitimize, you know, breaking 60 by making an eagle on the last hole, right? 58 versus 59 or whatever. So I ended up making an eagle on the 18th hole. And I pulled the ball out of the hole. And young man I was playing with said, did you just shoot 59? I go, no, 58. And I went to this to the table to add up my score, and it was 59. And I was sure that I was shooting. I just got lost, you know. I mean, I didn't know. I had made so many birdies, and then I started holing shots and made eagle on the last two holes, and I just kind of totally lost track of where I was. So kind of the joke was on me in the end, because I thought that I'd shot better than I did. And I spent like 5 minutes going over my scorecard going, no, that's not right. That's not right. Anyway, funny how things work out. You know, I almost walked off the course after the first round, decided to stick it out, ended up shooting that 59. So
a couple more before I let you go, and let's talk about this season. I know you got out there, you were in the field at Wailea for the Mitsubishi Electric Classic. You had back-to-back rounds of 69 in the second and third rounds. First of all, A, how are you feeling? Because I know you've been dealing with some injuries over the course of the last year, and how do you feel about the state of your game?
Yeah, nobody gets through this game without dealing with something, you know. And the last few years, the body is starting to be less responsive, you know, because the first couple steps getting out of bed in the morning, you feel like you're walking on pebbles. That's just the way life works, right? So I'm thrilled to still be playing. I'm going to be not playing full time because I'm not going to get in full time, but I'll play when I get in, and I'm looking forward to it. I don't play quite as well as I did 10 years ago, but I think that's part of the deal. And so this is probably my last year of making a semi-full commitment to what I'm doing. And I'll figure out something else to do. Maybe I'll come talk to you more often.
There you go.
We'll see what happens there. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm headed to Morocco on Sunday, so we'll see how that goes, and then attack the year as it comes to me.
So you're headed over to Morocco to play in a tournament over there hosted by Prince Rashid, in a tournament named in honor of his father. I'm guessing the accommodations, the food, and how you're taken care of over there in an event of that magnitude in that country for the Prince has got to be some of the best all season.
Well, it's just a very cool experience. We all come from somewhere else. You know, we may be second or third or fourth or fifth generation here in this country, but we all came from somewhere else. And I think it's kind of a cool thing to go abroad and see how other people do what they do. The first year we went to Morocco, we went to Marrakesh, which was made famous, at least in my mind, by Crosby, Stills, and Nash back in the 60s or 70s. And kind of a cool experience. And then, you know, it's in Rabat, which is the capital city, which is very much like any other capital city and yet very different because it's the capital city of Morocco. So, yeah, the food is different. There's a, you know, kind of a French cuisine influence to it. And the dates that they have on the first and 10th tees are absolutely spectacular, or sugar bombs. And it's just really kind of a cool experience to see how other cultures get along. And so a lot of us like going over there.
Oh, before I let you go, you got to give me an update. How's Junior and Alexandra? How are they doing?
They're doing great. Alexandra's got 5 new songs she posted on. She's got it on Spotify and Pandora and whatever, you know, .coms that they post that stuff. And so she's chugging along, writing her music and producing it and then recording it. And O's up qualifying right now for the Corn Ferry event in South America. I can't remember if it's Argentina or Chile. And so I'm sure he's going to call and give me a report. He shot 4 under yesterday, which missed the first one. And, you know, he's still knocking at it a little bit and trying to find his way the hard way, really, which is to qualify and play away on. So he's still got our full support, and he works his tail off, and we'll see where that goes.
Oh, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're out there doing, whether we're following you online or it's on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter like everybody else. I don't post much on Instagram. I'm more of a surfer in that regard. But you know, come on out and support the Champions Tour. We will interact with the fans. And they can get up close and ask a lot of questions, see how we're doing. Maybe we're a little bit more relatable, right? A little creakier than some of the young studs on the tour. And our backswings are a lot shorter than they used to be. And, you know, that whole thing, there's a lot of humor in what we do in these days. It's still good for a few laughs.
You guys are very accessible, and it's one of the, to me, it's the greatest tour to watch because you can interact with the players and you can get up close and personal. Plus, you guys still play golf at an incredible level. I think it's undersold how great the players are out on the Champions Tour. It's not like
our guys do an amazing job. Miller Brady and Jimmy Gabrielson and Dan Walker and guys like that. They're hustling to make our tour what it is, and then you got great players coming out there every year. There's an infusion of new talent, and the new talent generally is somebody that people already know, you know. So there's kind of like a connection to the history of the game and the legacy that has been established by all these great players, and it's a great way to continue following people's careers. And you know, Bernhard Langer doesn't look like he's slowing down anytime soon. He's 67 going on 68, shoots his age twice a week at least, and is in general a public peril on our tour. But there are great players, Ernie Els and Darren Clark and guys like that, Retief. Steven Alker is a story in and of himself, you know, a guy who kind of worked his way along Korn Ferry and PGA Tour for the longest time without tremendous success, but was able to stay in the game, and now he's become a dominant player out there. So there are a lot of good stories on our tour, and it's really been great to be out there 15 years and be a part of it.
Fantastic. Oh, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come back and be a part of the show. It's always a huge thrill for me to get to spend some time with you. I'm obviously rooting very hard for you, as always, my friend. Sending positive vibes your way. I hope we get this privilege of catching up with you again soon.
Oh, man, anytime. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and I'll see you in Atlanta, like always.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Take care, my friend. Well, all the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Back at you. Take care.
That is the great Olin Brown, folks. And just so if you're aware, Brown has an E on the end of it in the spelling of his last name, B-R-O-W-N-E. And Olin has just been a wonderful friend of this show over the many years that I've been doing, and he's been a part of it now 14 times. I've had the privilege of having him as part of the show. He's a wonderful follow on Twitter. Again, at Olin Brown is where you can find him. Plus, he's just a great player. I mean, don't undersell him for how great a college career he had. I mean, there's a reason why his college has their MVP named in his honor, and he's a member of their Hall of Fame. And then a guy that went out on tour, went out on the Korn Ferry Tour a few times, a couple of times out there on the PGA Tour, a senior major champion, 2011 U.S. Senior Open champion, and just a heck of a human being. I can't be more thankful to him for all the things, like I say, that he has meant to me. And then to have him here for the Mitsubishi Electric Classic, one of the senior tour wins that he had, and to be able to follow him around and watch him. The guy doesn't miss shots. I'm telling you, when I watch him play, that guy is consistent. Tee, green, fairways and greens, up and downs, great putter. He's just, like I say, one of the fun guys you get to watch nowadays out on the Champions Tour. And then to be able to walk some holes with him and chat with him during some practice rounds have been some of the great highlights I've had as a part of this show and just in my golfing life. So, huge thanks to O for all he's meant to me in the show. I'll catch up with him again, hopefully very, very soon. Okay, coming up next is another fantastic Champions Tour player, a guy who was a former U.S. amateur champion, won 5 times out on the PGA Tour, continuing to play very, very well out there on the Champions Tour, and that is Billy Mayfair. Before I bring Billy into the show, I want to remind you about our good friends over at On Point Golf and their fantastic On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023 and they were using an On Point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Okay, now back and next on the tee with me is Champions Tour pro Billy Mayfair. I've had the privilege of spending some time with Billy and his wonderful wife, Tammy, the last few years at the Mitsubishi Electric Classic here in Atlanta, and it has been some of the most enjoyable times that I've had over the last 2 years. They are both fantastic people. Billy is a heck of a player and has had a great career. Let me remind you a little bit about it. He's from Phoenix, Arizona. By age 15, he had become such a great junior player that Boys Life magazine featured him on the cover of their March 1981 edition. Played his college golf at Arizona State, where his 1986-87 scoring average of 70.59 is still among some of the best in school history. He won the 1986 U.S. Amateur Pub Links Tournament. He backed that up by winning the 1987 U.S. Amateur Championship, defeating Eric Redmond 4-3 at Jupiter Hills Golf Club. He won back-to-back Pacific Coast Amateur Championships in 1987 and 88. He also won the 87 Haskins Award for being the nation's best collegiate golfer and was a member of the Walker Cup team that year as well. In 1988, Billy turned pro, and he won 5 times out on the PGA Tour, also had 19 runner-up finishes and 91 top 10s. The Arizona Golf Association presents the Billy Mayfair Trophy to the local player with the lowest-weighted scoring average. And boy, I just couldn't be more excited that I get to have Billy back with me again here this week on Next on the Tee. Hey, Billy, how are you and Tammy doing?
Oh, we're doing really good. We've been home now for a couple months now with the off season, and we got settled back here in Arizona, and we're happy, and things are really going good. We are, though, looking forward to we leave this weekend for the start of the tour in Morocco on the Champions Tour, and we're both really looking forward to getting the year going.
So I want to come back to that in a minute. But before we get into this season and next week's tournament, I got to ask you, as a guy who is an Arizona State alum, your Sun Devils had a heck of a college football season. I mean, ended up losing a close one to Texas, but back-to-back 3-9 seasons to get into the playoffs and make a big run had to be a heck of a year.
Oh, it was. It was a lot of fun with the new coach. We had a new AD there at the school, and everything turned around really quick, and he's a good young coach. I think he's the youngest coach in the NCAA, and he's a go-getter, and has done a wonderful job. The athletic director immediately secured him for 5-6 years in there, and he says it's his dream job. So hopefully he can continue the Sun Devils going and all that. The tough part now is that they're a target now, so it's going to get a little bit tougher and all that, but it was really fun to make the playoffs. I thought we were going to beat Texas, a couple bad calls there at the end, but it was great to see. It was great for the Sun Devil Nation and got us all pepped up again.
Yeah, I was rooting hard for you guys because as a Steelers fan, you guys have Hines Ward as your wide receivers coach, and I wanted to see Hines add a national championship ring to his 2 Super Bowl rings. So I was rooting hard for you guys. Disappointed to your point. A couple of tough calls there at the end. It might have been different.
Might have been different, but that's the nice thing that Arizona State has an outstanding coaching staff. Hines Ward, a few other NFL players are on there too, and all that to really get the guys ready to take the next step.
All right, so switching gears back over to golf, and you mentioned going over to Morocco for next week's tournament, and I was talking to Owen Brown the other day asking him the same question, but getting to play in a tournament hosted by Prince Rashid, and a tournament named in the honor of his late father, the King. And Prince Rashido, by the way, is a pretty good player in his own right.
Yes.
He teamed with Mark Leishman not all that long ago to win the Pro-Am at the Travelers Championship. But I'm guessing the accommodations, the food, everything around the tournament hosted by the Prince has got to be pretty good.
Yes, it is. Yeah, they take very good care of us. We have a charter flight by them coming out of Miami. They take us right over to Morocco. And as soon as we get picked there, we're treated like kings. They pick us up at the airport. They take us to the hotel. They take us back and forth from the golf course. If you go hungry that week, it's your own fault. That's for sure. There's always plenty of food. And it's just a fun place to go. It's a fun place to start the year. And it's a nice golf course. It's kind of tree lined and the greens are a little severe in spots. But it's a great place to start the year at.
So how do you feel about the state of your game going into this season?
I feel a lot better. I had kind of a rough year last year, probably one of my worst years I've had. Had some injuries, have corrected that, have gotten back into shape, and feel like I'm hitting it good, chipping, putting well, and all that good stuff. And, you know, but you got to get out there and play. You know, you can practice and play here all you want at home, but I'm anxious to get back on the road and play against the best best guys in the world out there on the tour and see how my game's faring. But I feel much better this year than I did probably last year going into the season.
Billy, do you set goals for yourself at the beginning of the season like this? Are there things that you have either circled that you want to achieve, places that you want to play, and is there something that you're really striving for?
I don't know if I really say I set goals. I have things I want to do. I mean, I guess that would be kind of a goal, but, you know, I don't want to sit there and say that I want, hey, this many top 10 finishes or this many wins. You know, I've always one of these who just, you know, you take one week at a time and you prepare and you let those things happen. But because if you set goals, you know, once you reach them, you know, what else is there? So, you know, I never like doing that. But I just try to take every week, one week at a time. And you know, I still, you know, every time I tee it up, I want to win. That's for sure.
Billy, when I was looking back over your stats for last season, at one point you birdied six consecutive par threes, which is one of the harder things to do out on tour, considering the length of the par threes that you guys play. That tells me that the ball striking with your irons was really good, at least at that point in the season. Is that the strength of your game now? And if not, what do you consider it to be?
Well, I always thought on the big tour when I played, my strength was always driving the ball and putting. But I would think now I've gotten older. Surprisingly, I think my long iron play, four irons, five irons, hybrid woods and all that, I seem to have a knack for. In fact, I think when I made those six birdies in a row, I think I bogeyed three or four par fives in the process. So that doesn't do you much good. But I've always been a high ball hitter. So with those long irons, that helps a lot. But let's just say this, Chris. So this offseason, I've done a lot more work with my wedges and short irons than my long irons because I know I can hit my long irons really well.
And along those lines, Billy, I mean, equipment manufacturers obviously are coming out with new clubs and new golf ball technology every year. I was talking to David Peoples about this, and he was blown away by how much better clubs are now versus what he had in his bag. How often do you try out each new year's latest and greatest equipment? Are you looking every year, or do you go a couple of years? How long do you wait?
Well, it depends, I think, a lot on how you're playing. I mean, Titleist is always coming out with a new golf ball. You're always trying that during the off season, which I have. You know, I've gone out to Ping. I've gotten some new irons from them. I think anytime when you have kind of a not the season that you want the year before, you're always kind of looking for a change. Maybe just to maybe look at something a little bit different and kind of give you a feel. So I've changed a lot of things in my bags. I think for the last 2 years up to this point, I've had the same clubs in the bag. This year, I've got new irons, new wedges, and all that. So I think that a little bit has to do about the way you played, the way I played last year. But you got to keep up with the time, because if you have technology or irons or golf balls that are 3, 4, 5 years old, you're going to lose out because the technology is getting better and better every year. So you got to make changes.
Billy, looking back over the course of your career, you came into the game at a time when legends like Nicklaus Palmer, Player, Trevino, guys from that era, they were either nearing the end of their PGA Tour careers or had already transitioned over onto the Champions Tour. But did you get an opportunity to play alongside guys of that ilk? And if so, what are some of your favorite stories and the things that you picked up and learned from those guys along the way?
Well, I was a little bit behind those guys. Obviously, I got to play with Jack. I got to open up one of his golf courses up here at Desert Mountain. I've got to play with Arnold. I got to, one of the greatest stories, I got to play with Arnold the second round at Augusta National. You know, and that was just, you know, an absolute thrill. I got to play a couple rounds at Memorial in the actual tournament with Jack. So I've had my experiences. One of my best stories is I was a U.S. amateur champion in 1988, went back to play at Augusta and played the first round with the defending champion, Larry Mize. And Chris, back then, you know, we didn't have cell phones or technology. We had to actually call Augusta National Golf Club and call, and, you know, I'm Billy Mayfair. I shot 77 today and get your tee time. And they said, oh, Mr. Mayfair, you're at 10:10 tomorrow with Mr. Palmer. And I just kind of stood there. My parents were there with me. And they go, who are you playing with? I said, I'm playing with the King, Arnold. And it was a kind of a sleepless night, that's for sure. But, you know, Arnold handled it so beautifully. We had such a great time. And we were probably not going to make the cut. But the way Arnold played, the way he tried on every shot, just grinded out there like you can't believe. showed me a lot. It taught me a lot. But what my best story is, you know, obviously we're going to come up 18, and you know, I was already prepared to hit my shot and then move off to the side so that Arnold could walk up 18 by himself and all that stuff. And I'm off to the side, and all of a sudden he kind of gives me the wave and get my butt over there. And we walked up 18 shoulder to shoulder. And that was something that I will never, ever forget.
No doubt. And Billy, as you know, I'm a Pittsburgh guy, and I'm so excited that the U.S. Open is back at Oakmont this year. And speaking of Mr. Palmer, I was looking back at the 1994 U.S. Open that was played there, and that being his last U.S. Open, you played in that tournament as well. You were paired with Scott Verplank and Sam Randolph for the first couple of rounds, and you guys actually had a really early tee time on that Friday, 6:30 a.m., which I'm guessing they did because, as I look back, the heat was stifling that week in Pittsburgh. What do you remember about that U.S. Open?
Oh, it was hot. It was horribly hot. At the time, we still had, you know, the golf course still had trees at the time. And I think that made it even more humid and warmer in there. But I just remember how they had to try to keep the golf course as moist and as wet as possible. And I know the USGA does never like putting water on the golf course, but you had to that week. But, you know, it was just, it's such a hard golf course. In fact, I think it's the hardest one in the world for me to play. But it was just a grind, and we, you know, the 6:30 time to get out early and when the weather was pretty good was a huge advantage. My best Oakmont story to me was the first time I ever got to play there. I played it in a tournament, just a little pro-am tournament, and never played the golf course, showed up on Monday to play and drove it right down number 10 fairway and hit a little six iron in there about 10 feet from the hole. And, you know, I thought, you know, what's so hard about this golf course? As I walked off the green with a six,
wow!
I realized real quick how hard Oakmont was. So, you know, I know the golf course is always in great shape. I know they've done a lot with the trees there and opened it up and all that. But it is a hard golf course, that's for sure.
Did you ever find yourself in the church pews?
I've walked by the church pews. I've said, but fortunately, no. I never had to hit it out of the church pews. No. Well, I might still be there, Chris. You know.
Yeah. And getting back to that 94 U.S. Open, Mr. Palmer teed off a couple hours after you on that Friday. And obviously, like I say, that was his last U.S. Open that he played in. And he held a very tearful press conference at the conclusion of that. Did you stick around at all to see it?
We watched. I did stick around to watch him finish and all that. I didn't go into the press conference, but we did stay there. And like I said, it was about an hour behind me. And we did watch him come up 18. And you know, it was just, you know, the emotion and the electricity in the air was something else. But just to see Mr. Palmer's emotion, you know, you could tell that he was very touched by it. But, you know, knowing him as competitive as he is, he still probably wanted to keep on playing in that. But it was the right time, and it was very emotional for him.
Billy, speaking of competitive, I don't think enough people know or understand how hard it is for guys like you to get out onto the Champions Tour, first of all, to be able to qualify for it, and then to stick around and stay there. Talk about how competitive the Champions Tour is and the challenge to be able to continue to play out there year after year.
Well, it obviously it's, you know, the Champions Tour is kind of a reward for the guys who played a lot on the big tour, you know, and made, you know, played very well on the big tour. It's kind of their reward. It's also a chance for other people and other players who maybe didn't play the tour now at 50 to try to go out and live a dream. And there's a lot of players out there doing that. But, you know, this, you know, everyone thinks we play real short golf courses, have little wedge shots. And you know, that's why we shoot such low numbers. These golf courses are very long. We're driving the ball just as far now as we did as when we were on the big tour because of technology. But, you know, the golf courses are long. They're set up tough. And, you know, these guys out here can really play. And for a lot of guys who are turning 50, think it's just going to be a cakewalk when you come out there. You know, you still got a guy named Bernhard Langer who's still knocking him dead, and he's in his 60s. So, but you know, as any other sport, any other time, you know, Father Time is going to catch up to you, and it caught up to me a little bit last year, and I didn't respect that, and I've tried to do better this year. But you know, it's just like on the big tour, you just got to every January, every February, you just got to be ready to go.
Does Father Time catch up to everybody? I'm not sure it's caught up to Bernhard Langer yet. I mean, to your point a moment ago, he's 67 years old. He's out there shooting lower than his age all the time, still wins golf tournaments. Somehow he's eluded father time. How's that possible?
Well, he's always taking good care of himself. He's always eating real well. He's done that. But, I've seen him in the locker room, and I know his feet hurt at times. I know his leg hurt him a great deal last year after his little accident playing pickleball and all that stuff. But, he still was able to win the Charles Schwab Cup. So, he's like that Energizer bunny. He just keeps on going. So I'm happy for him.
Billy, I want to go back to your U.S. Amateur Championship in 87. Like I mentioned in your intro, you beat Eric Redmond 3-2 to win the title. And I know Eric had to beat two-time champion Jay Siegel and Scott Gump, who was the medalist, just to get into the finals with you. So you beat the guy who beat the guys. But prior to the U.S. Open, Redmond's claim to fame really was just being an extra in Caddyshack. He wasn't really ranked all that highly at all. So I feel like you must have been stacked with additional pressure, because this guy is now the Cinderella story, if you don't mind the Caddyshack reference. He comes from out of nowhere, and now you got to go beat that guy.
Well, I really, at the time when we played the match, I really didn't know all that much about it. I had heard that, I knew who he had beaten. I knew he had beaten Jay Siegel and Scott Gump, who were playing very good. I know that he was playing well. I knew he played at the University of Tennessee. So I knew I had someone I had to play who had a hot hand. But, in match play, it was just one of those weeks. I think we were both very tired. It was hot down there in West Palm Beach in August. Jupiter Hills is very hilly. It was just a grind all week. And, I really putted very well that week. I didn't hit the ball as well as I always like to, but I remember how well I putted, especially in the finals. I made a lot of really good par putts. And in match play, when you make a par putt on your opponent, that just takes all the steam out of your opposition. And I did that quite a bit in the finals. In fact, I actually watched the finals again while we were home during the off season. And I think I made three or four putts over 20 feet for par. And, I just took the steam out of Eric completely. And I was fortunate enough to win.
Speaking of 20 footers, you won the 1993 Greater Milwaukee Open. You did so with another great friend of the show, Mark Calcavecchia, plus Ted Schultz was in that playoff as well. And you won that in dramatic fashion. You made a 20-foot chip shot for birdie on the fourth hole to beat Mark. Ted got eliminated after the first playoff hole, but you shoot rounds of 67, 66, 69, 68 to win it. But talk about winning it with that chip in.
Well, it was a thrill. It was my first PGA Tour win. It was, to get to be in a playoff and with a good friend of mine like Mark Calcavecchia was. And it was funny. It was on the 10th hole. And I remember I missed the green to the left, and he hit it in there pretty close. I know he was inside of me. And, I chipped it in, and he ended up missing his putt. So I went, trying to just get to the next hole to winning the tournament. So it was a surprise. I think the funniest story about that one was they actually went off the air. ABC was covering it, and they went off the air. Nowadays they would never do that, but my parents were home watching it, and they went off the air. They didn't show the playoff on TV. So my parents didn't know for about an hour afterwards, because the internet wasn't like it was and stuff. But ABC actually went off the air, so my parents sitting at home didn't know what happened until I called them, which was about an hour later. So that was a killer for them,
no doubt. And speaking of them, when we've talked in the past, you've told me that you realized that you were probably going to be good enough to make a living playing professional golf when you were a junior at Arizona State. What I didn't know until I was doing more research on you is you decided to turn pro at that point. You didn't tell your parents that you weren't going back to school. What was that like, trying to finally tell them, get the courage to say, hey, I'm going to go make a living here on the tour?
Well, I school wasn't my best subject. I struggled in time. I know now why, because of my autism. I think why I struggled so much in college. And I knew I wanted to turn pro. I knew tour school was coming up. I think the giveaway on all that was when Ping sent me a tour bag to the house with my name on it. My mom opened it up and saw it. I think she kind of realized I was turning pro. And they wanted me to go back to school, but even when I decided to turn pro and go to tour school, they did support me and all that. But I think when the tour bag showed up at the house with my name on it, I think that's when they kind of knew what my decision was going to be.
Billy, I want to kind of get your thoughts on what's going on around the PGA Tour nowadays, because when you won the tour championship in 1995, the total purse that year was $3 million. By far the largest purse on tour that year. Now the average purse is, you know, in the somewhere between $8 million and $25 million. Yeah. $1 million, you know, on in an average purse back in 1995. Heck, a guy finishing second gets that much money nowadays. But I'm starting to get concerned, Billy, that there's so much money out there now that we're going to get to a point where things are a house of cards and things are going to fall in. I just don't know how the system can continue to support how far and how much purses have escalated. And we're starting to see some sponsors get squeezed. Heck, the LPGA Tour just had a sponsor back out and didn't even pay their tab for last year. Concerned at all about what you're seeing, that, you know, maybe this isn't actually really good for the game at the pro level?
I'm very concerned. I don't think I'm sad to hear that about the LPGA. I know that the Shriners tournament in Las Vegas this year was the first time, I think, in 30, 35 years that they weren't the sponsor. I don't quite know or understand sometimes the PGA Tour's thinking or the commissioner's thinking behind some of the decisions, especially when you're making fields now smaller, you're cutting fields in half. And you're making it, you know, tournaments with 78, 80 players, and you're still paying them all that much money. At some point, it's going to be hard to fill fields. But more importantly than anything else, it's just, you know, the quality of play and how many people are out there. And they really need to, they really need to wake up and take a look at this, because it is a serious problem. I know, I guess my biggest thing is I just don't understand why the PGA Tour is trying to almost copy LIV in a way. When the PGA Tour has the power, they have everything, and they're trying to copy a little bit what LIV Tour is doing. And I just don't understand that. But I'm very concerned. I'm also very concerned when you turn on the broadcast and you look at the names on the TV and you don't recognize hardly any of the names anymore. Before, when you used to turn on, you used to know all the names and where they were from and all that. And you just don't do that. So somewhere along the way, someone at the tour is dropping the ball here, and it needs to be picked up, or you're going to have competition like LIV come in and make a big impact.
Yeah. So let's take that a step further, Billy, because I don't understand that either. I mean, I feel like the PGA Tour and its product, if you will, for decade upon decade was really good. And then LIV came along, and I was saying this to Olin Brown the other day. I feel like it's kind of like, remember in the 80s when Pepsi came along and, you know, they had Michael Jackson and all those guys on commercials, and then Coke had to come out, thought they had to come out with new Coke when Coke was just fine. You didn't need to react to this other company, and that became such a huge disaster. I feel like the PGA Tour has kind of overreacted to LIV and thinking they have to do everything that LIV is doing short of shorts and music. I don't think it was necessary to do all of that.
I agree. I don't think it was necessary at all. The PGA Tour has been around here for a while. LIV to me is still just it's just a sheet in the pants. I mean, I don't think they're going to be around for much longer. I didn't think Greg Norman would last as long as he did, because that's his type. But, you know, it's just very concerning. And I can understand why players go to LIV. I know that the money's real good. It's guaranteed. And I know that the PGA Tour has a lot of issues that the players don't want to deal with, so they go and play LIV. And the tour's made those changes because they don't want these young players to go and sign up for LIV. They want to show you that, hey, you come out here, you can do this. And to me, they don't need to do it. You know, Chris, I'll give you a perfect example right here in Phoenix. Next Monday at the Phoenix Open will be the last Monday qualifying ever for the Phoenix Open. And, you know, it's horrible. They've taken away the section spot. They've now taken away the three spots on Monday that qualify for the tournament. They're increasing the purse, and they're shrinking the field. And to me, that just doesn't make any sense. Plus, let's remember this, it's taken about $250,000 out of the section's pocket here in Southwest section's pocket, because now you don't have the Monday qualifier. So, shame on you, PGA Tour, because you shouldn't be doing this. You should be trying to help players. You should be helping more players. You should be helping the sections. You should be doing all this. And they're killing them. And they're going in the wrong direction really fast.
Yeah. And I think I share that exact same sentiment, Billy, because to me, the you talk about money out of the section's pocket. I mean, our PGA and LPGA professionals, to me, have done such a wonderful job over the last several years growing this game. We have tee sheets full all over the country, thanks to them. And I mean, obviously, COVID, the one silver lining of COVID is it got more people to take up the game of golf, because that was one of the things we could do is go be outside. Right. But the game has steadily grown since then, and people have stayed with the game. But what we're seeing now is fewer people watching the PGA Tour on TV. Ratings were down about 20% last year. Yep. And I think that's because people are tired of what we're seeing, not only with this decision to reduce fields and the money issue and the, you know, the LIV versus PGA Tour. It's become all about money and all that sort of thing. I feel like the tour and professional golf is going the wrong direction while the game is at its most popular that it's probably ever been. It's a shame that we can't marry those two things up. I just don't understand the decision making.
I don't either. I agree with you 100%. I think after COVID, it showed how popular the game came back. I mean, of one of the few things after COVID that did get very popular, and golf was one of them. The decisions that Jay Monahan is making at the tour just don't make sense to me. I don't know if he is scared of losing his job, which they just renewed his contract. I don't know if he's that scared of LIV or if he's just that scared of the competition, but he doesn't need to be. The PGA Tour is going to be just fine. The charities are going to do great. But, you know, when he goes on TV and says that the TV audience is stronger than ever, that's not the truth. I think we are losing our TV audience a great deal. And when you show tournaments, you know, all the time on TV, and you know the Champions Tour, you think you got to wait, you got to stay up to 10:30 at night or midnight to watch the Champions Tour. That's just not good business.
No, it isn't. And I tell you, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I try to stay up to watch you guys, it's hard to do. It's late at night and all that sort of thing. I think it dilutes what you guys are doing. I think to me, what the Champions Tour is the best tour out there, because you guys are accessible. You're good guys. You interact with the fans. I think it's one of the best experiences you can have. If you want to go watch professional golf, go watch the Champions Tour, because A, as you said earlier on, these guys are good, to steal a phrase, and you guys are still playing golf at a very high level. But on top of that, you get better access to the players, that the guys that were your heroes, you know, back in the day. I think they're doing you guys a disservice by putting you on that late.
Well, I do too. I do too. Especially when, you know, you have a PGA Tour play and then you got to replay it, and then you show the Champions Tour. It's disrespectful to us. More people recognize the names on the Champions Tour than they do the PGA Tour. And Chris, let's don't forget about something here too. In about 3 years from now, the Champions Tour could be actually more popular than the Big Tour when we get one player to come out there to play with us, and that's Tiger Woods. If Tiger Woods comes out and plays in a Champions Tour event, it will blow the PGA Tour out of the water. ESPN will start with them. All the major golf companies or networks will talk about the Champions Tour before they talk about the PGA Tour. Now, I know that probably Jay and Tiger have sat there and talked about this between the two of them. But, you know, I find it very interesting. Now, do I think Tiger is going to come out and take the Champions Tour by storm? No, I don't. I don't. He's played five tournaments in the last 2 years. You know, I know he's hurting. I know his leg hurts. I know he can take a card on the Champions Tour, but I still don't think he'll come out and play a lot on the Champions Tour. I think he'll try to play the majors. But still, even with just by that, or just even by just Tiger turning 50 will give the Champions Tour such a high buzz. I don't know if the PGA Tour could handle it.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% by that. Now, again, he's going to turn 50 in December. So a year from now, theoretically, he could be out there playing periodically on the Champions Tour, which, to your point, would absolutely, the ratings would dwarf, you know, the PGA Tour. I mean, as much as I love the guys that play out there, and Scotty and JT and Jordan and, you know, list of, you know, great players. But there is no question there's going to be more eyes and ears on the Champions Tour if and when, whatever tournament it is, that Tiger decides to go out there and play. it is really going to blow the PGA Tour away. I'm curious, just like you, to see how Jay handles that.
Well, I think we all are. I know that Jay and Tiger talk a lot. They're close, the two of them, so I'm sure that they're discussing stuff like that. But we'll just kind of have to just kind of wait and see. Chris, I'm thank you for talking about this. I think the state of the game, I think the state of the PGA Tour is in chaos. I don't think it's running smooth, which it should be. And some issues definitely need to be resolved here real quick.
Billy, just a couple more before I let you go. And you're 58 years old now. And like I say, you look at Bernhard and seeing how great that he continues to play at 67. You would theoretically have a lot longer to play and be really good. How much longer do you want to be out there?
Oh, my wife's not here right now, or she'd say, for until I'm 80, but, anything to get me out of the house. But, I don't know, Chris. I love to play. I love to compete. I mean, I'm going into right now my 36th year to play on the tour, and I'm excited. I can't wait to get on the airplane. I can't wait to get back out there and see what I can do. So even after 36 years of doing this, I'm still excited. So, I hate to say I want to quit at this time or this point. I think Father Time and my mind and everything will let me decide that. But I want to continue playing as long as I can.
Billy, you mentioned earlier autism, and you have a foundation that you have put together to help give back to that community. Talk about that.
Well, I was diagnosed with high functioning autism. And my wife and I have done a lot of work with autism around the country and all that. And our main focus being not just only to help the people who have autism, but to help the family members of an autistic person, because they are left out a lot, the parents, the grandparents, the other siblings in the family. So my wife and I have tried to do things to help that, to make more awareness. I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago and heard some great responses from people. People out there are becoming that this is a very national thing. Autism it affects about everyone at some point or not. So Tammy and I are very excited. We'd love to talk about this stuff. We'd love to help people, to give them suggestions. And at BillyMayford.org, you can tune into and see what we're doing and what we're going. And like I said, we're moving real fast here. My wife's writing a book right now, and we're trying to help a lot of people out there.
Speaking of Tammy's book, and I'm jonesing to read that thing. Where are you, or where is she with that? And when can we look forward to getting our first copy to read it?
Well, Tammy's still working on it patiently and all that. And once we can redo it a few times and get it edited and get it out, Chris, you know you'll be one of the first people to have a copy of it. I promise you that.
I'm looking forward to it. Billy, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can we stay up to date with all the great things that you're out there doing, whether we're following you online or it's on social media?
Like I said, BillyMayford.org is probably the best website to catch me onto. If you have comments about golf, about me, about autism and all that, lock onto there and help me out. And like I said, I'm playing a full schedule this year. And if you get out to one of our Champions Tour events or around, yell at me and I'd love to talk to people about it. So I'm excited about my 36th year coming up. And, it's maybe, Chris, we can talk real soon with a big W by my name.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that day.
Yeah.
Billy, it's always a huge thrill to get to spend some time with you. I'm looking forward to seeing you and Tammy again this year out at TPC Sugarloaf for the Mitsubishi Electric Classic out there. I hope we get an opportunity to spend some time together in between now and then. I'm rooting hard for you, and hopefully we get to catch up again soon.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me on, and Happy New Year. And to all the fans out there watching, and keep watching the Champions Tour and listening to Chris, because he'll keep you up to date.
There you go. Take care, Billy. All the best to you and Tammy. Look forward to catching up with you soon. We'll talk soon.
Sounds good, Chris. Thank you, sir.
See you, Billy.
Bye-bye.
That is the great Billy Mayfair, folks. Can I tell you how great of an individual he is? And on top of that, he's got a fantastic wife. Tammy's just outstanding. She was on the program last year. Hopefully we get to have her back on before too long as well. But two great individuals. Billy's still out there playing great golf. He's had a great career from junior golf all the way through college, the PGA Tour, and now the Champions Tour. But on top of that, he is just an outstanding individual, and they are doing great things for the folks that are dealing with autism, from the actual person that's dealing with autism to the people and the family around them that are having to try to figure out what do they do now? How do we handle these sorts of things? So they have to learn how to cope with that as well. And they're doing great things to help those folks. So go out there and check out the Billy Mayfair Foundation, support them, learn some things about what's going on. I can't say enough great things about those two individuals. I'm very excited that I'm going to get to see them again this May at the Mitsubishi Electric Classic. Again, like I said at the top of the interview, those 2 hours, the last couple of years, have just been two of the best hours I've had all year. I can't say how much I enjoy those two people enough. Looking forward to catching up with both of them again very soon. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this special edition of Next on the Tee. My thanks again to Olin Brown and Billy Mayfair for making both of these segments so much fun to be a part of. I hope you joined it as well. And I can't thank you all enough for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts, bar none. Until next time, hit them straight, my friends.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.